Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 464. In this episode, Scott talks with Clojure expert Karen Meyer about how to get started with this powerful functional language.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm talking with Karen Meyer from Outpace Systems. She's you studied physics in college, but you also were a professional ballet dancer, so you've got experience spanning many years and many disciplines. Thanks for chatting with me today.
Thanks for having me.
You have a book coming out, though, that I'm very excited about called Living Clojure, and this is going to be coming out just in a couple months, right?
That is correct. I'm very excited, too.
What was it about the Clojure language that made you feel like there was a book inside you and you needed to get it out?
Well, I love Clojure. I was so happy when I finally discovered it. It brought a lot of joy to my programming, and I wanted to be able to share that language and get people into it. But I noticed around me that some people were having trouble getting into the language. We have a local user group in Cincinnati, which is great. But I hear people sometimes saying, I tried to learn Clojure over the weekend and I had a really hard time doing it. I guess it's just not for me. And it happened at the same time I was actually trying to run a 5K, and I've never run before. And I kept trying to run, and I think I would do too much and end up failing and just figure, oh, I just can't run. And then I finally came into this program. I think it was called Ease into 5K. And it actually had a plan for you that said, oh, you don't do it all in a weekend or you don't do it all in 2 weeks. You just build up gradually. And that finally, after doing that and not doing too much too fast, I was finally able to run a 5K. So it kind of a bell went off in my head saying, hey, you know what? Maybe the same approach to learning language is the same way as, learning to run or learning anything. The reason I think that people run into trouble is they try to do too much too fast. So the point of the book is an introduction, but it's also to give a paced training plan that's gradual.
What do you think it is about the state of programming languages today that makes people feel like, you know, if I can't learn it in 15 minutes, then, well, forget it. Like, if it's not tweet-sized, if this entire language grammar doesn't fit inside a tweet, then it's not for me. I mean, Clojure is not C# or Java. It's not something that you just figure out in a couple of hours.
Yeah, I think, well, there's a couple contributing factors to that, right? I mean, for me and for a lot of people coming from an object-oriented language like Ruby or Java or any other language that's different than functional, it's all about a different way of thinking. And that's training your brain fundamentally to think in a different way. And I don't think it's really easy to do that over the course of a weekend. And the other factor is just the pace of change now and with Twitter and with blogs, and I love it. I love the pace of innovation and technology, but it does feel overwhelming sometimes. You feel very pressured to learn the next thing or learn it fast as you can, cram it in.
This is is it correct to call this a Lisp?
It is, yeah. Clojure is a Lisp.
So what does that mean for people who, let's think about who's listening to this show. Like, they've heard the word Lisp. Maybe they learned it for a week or two in college and forgot it, and 20 years has gone by. And they have a sense that, well, there's smart people and they know what Lisp is. But then there's me, and I drag buttons onto a form. And I kind of, you know, I'm speaking actually about myself. You know what I mean? Like, I intellectualize Lisp, but I always feel like there's a level of discourse that's happening around the concept of Lisp and a Lisp that I'm not able to participate in.
Yeah. Well, I guess, Lisp is, it comes from, I think it's Lisp processing. I forget exactly what it stands for. But the thing that I love about it is it's just such a simple syntax, and there's so little to remember, which really suits me. It's a very regular syntax. There's lots of parens, but and I know people get scared at that, like, oh my gosh, all the parens, what am I going to do? But really, when you get a editor that handles the parens for you, they just kind of seem to disappear. And you can actually move things back and forth really efficiently. And people have actually come to think of the parens as hugs for their code.
That is very cool. Whenever I think about Lisp and parentheses, I think about the classic XKCD number 297, where they hand, you know, Obi-Wan basically comes over and hands someone a pile of parentheses and says, these are your father's parentheses. Elegant weapons for a more civilized age. Closure has been, Lisp rather has been around for forever, you know, 1958.
Yeah.
And, when you say though, a Lisp, that's where I think things get a little interesting, because there's the Lisp proper noun, but now it has become a generic term for other people's Lisps.
Right. So there are different dialects of Lisps, and, like Common Lisp, and I guess Closure is another dialect, and Scheme, and, to tell you quite frankly, I don't know exactly how they all differ, but fundamentally, they are all about processing lists, and your code is in a nested list of lists, and they execute and evaluate these forms and list structures. So at the very core, it's a very beautiful structure, and I wouldn't get too hung up in the different dialects, and that's just my personal opinion.
Your personal opinion is all it matters.
Of, you know, how I know people can argue that it's not exactly this sort of Lisp because it's missing this exact syntax or whatever.
Some people have said that they think of Closure as being like an extremely they call it a power language, right? Like, if you were going to pick between Haskell and Closure, they're like, well, you know, Haskell's great. There's some things you can do with it in production. But if you're really serious, you want to get some work done, you go with Closure because it is fully and completely compiled and it runs on the Java VM. I think there's also one that runs in the .NET runtime, but it also remains completely dynamic. It's not an academic language, but in any case, like, you're doing real work and getting real stuff done with this.
Yeah. I mean, I've been using it in my day job for quite a while, and we love it. Feel highly productive in it. We use it for the back end, for web services, for APIs. But we also use it in the front end in the browser now with ClojureScript. So this makes it very compelling that there is a few different dialect changes between ClojureScript and Closure. ClojureScript is sort of a subset of Closure, but allows you to work in the same language, basically in the same mindset in the front end and in the back end, which is just lovely.
Really? So while everyone is off talking about things like Node and look how wonderful it is that I can write JavaScript in the server and JavaScript in the client, you are still doing the exact same thing except in the language that speaks more to your soul.
That's right.
That is amazing. And this is something that's production ready. I mean, someone could go into Closure and also ClojureScript and not feel in any way that they were living on the cutting edge of, you know, like, I don't know about going into production with all this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's gotten a whole lot of traction lately. So I think it was on the ThoughtWorks, like, adopt radar for the past couple years. And I've just noticed personally just many, many companies using it in production. So if you're a Closure developer, it's a happy time. There's quite a few jobs out there now.
Someone compared, now I know that this is a weird comparison, but they compared Closure and its ecosystem to Python. in the sense of it has this all these tools. There's so many of them. It's very straightforward. It's very flexible, but it'll take you a long way. You could write a little script in it and a little utility, or you could go and make a whole distributed cluster in Amazon Web Services, all with Clojure.
Yeah, I can't speak to the Python ecosystem because I'm not really familiar with it, but the Clojure ecosystem is really good. There's many libraries like AWS, anything that you'd really need, and it also has the flexibility that you can on the server side use your favorite Java libraries as well, because it's got the JVM interop. And on the Clojure Scripts guide side, you can also use JavaScript libraries as well. So it's got a lot of flexibility.
Is the Java integration and the fact that it primarily runs on the JVM like something that comes up a lot? Like, are you finding yourself saying, like, this problem is solvable because of this really great, tight Java integration? Like, when you have a sense like you're interoping, like you drop into Java, like if you find a Java class library,
yeah,
like, oh, I'll just
yeah.
Call that.
So it's not all the time, but definitely it's common. For example, I'm just thinking of a random thing, but like generating a UUID. You can just drop down to the Java interop and say, hey, Java UUID, give me a new one. And you don't have to write a Clojure method to do that. But there is a Clojure library if you want to use a Clojure library that wraps that and adds some additional functionality to it. You can use that instead.
Mm-hmm. Is Clojure what they call a pure functional language?
It is not a pure functional programming language in that it does embrace side effects. And side effects are things like, writing a print statement, writing, doing input and output stuff. So it's not a pure functional programming language in that respect. But it does manage state and side effecty things in a sane fashion. So it's not,
in a sane fashion.
Yeah, okay. It's in control. So it's not spread all over the place.
So is it fair to say that it definitely is unquestionably a functional language. It is a functional, Lisp, and it is attempting to do those things that functional languages do well.
Yes. But it's a practical language. And I think that's what makes it so, good for just general use, because although it doesn't have the purity of, say, Haskell, it is functional, and it does let you do your job and your work in a very
does that imply that purely functional languages are like really cool and they make you do nice Fibonacci sequences, but when it comes to getting work done, they
that might be an unfair comparison, but
indeed. So in your book, you go through the structure of Clojure and some of the flow, but you get right into concurrency really early on, like chapter 3. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Is that because Clojure is really good at that, or because it's just a very concurrent time we're living in?
It is. Well, both. I mean, but Clojure, that's one of its driving points. And that's one of the things that, made me first explore it was the ability to handle concurrency in a nice way. That sort of thing is like really hard in Java, which was the language I was coming from. It's got many different approaches depending on what you're looking for. But mutable state in a general sense is not something that's spread along your code in a spaghetti fashion. So it allows you to actually handle concurrency.
Mm-hmm. And your background before Clojure was really all Java. You spent like 15 years writing Java.
Yeah, I did some Java and then some Ruby as well.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel like, was the language structure of Clojure that made it most attractive to you? Or did you care that it ran on the JVM or not? Like, was that helpful in your decision to kind of switch from Java to Clojure?
I think it was definitely helpful that it ran on the JVM and that I could have the interop, with it. But the selling point that really just made me fall in love with it was, the simplicity of it being Lisp and also the interactive nature of development, that you have this REPL, which is what you work in, that you can really get fast feedback and play with your data structures and almost sculpt your code as you're writing it. And if you pair that with you can use a lot of editor choices. I use Emacs, but there's IntelliJ and Eclipse has plugins, but it really
So if you would excuse my ignorance, you're sitting here and you're writing a closure program. What kind of things do you have open? You've got Emacs open. Is that it? You're basically full screen Emacs and you just switch between buffers? Where's your REPL?
Yeah. So, the REPL is actually in Emacs. So, I use a plugin for Emacs where you can jack in to your closure code, which sounds pretty nice.
That sounds pretty awesome and matrixy.
So you jack in, you get a REPL going, and then you can actually just kind of start driving through your code, and a form is kind of what you call, or an expression is the stuff in between the parens. So you can go to the end of a paren and you can do a keystroke and it'll just evaluate it. So you could just, you know, scroll through your code and, you know, sort of interactively evaluate it and port it over to another buffer and work with it. And people call this REPL driven development. So it's a really nice way to play with stuff, get an idea of where you want to go with it. And then you can bring it into a test or, you know, depending on what your workflow is at the time. But
one of the things that happens in the non-functional languages that I'm familiar with is that debugging is a challenge because there's so much setup to get into the function that needs to do what you want to do. So it's, you know, it's like, you know, start debugging and step, and make sure the state is correct. And then once I get to this point, now I'm ready. So you spend less time actually writing the code and more time getting the state correct.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the advantages of functional programming, right? That you kind of strive for these small functions that, you know, ideally they don't have side effects. So if you run them with the same inputs, they're always going to give you the same output. So it makes your code a lot easier to test and debug.
Mm-hmm. And not only do you go into concurrency really quick, you spend an entire chapter of your book talking about core.async.
Yeah, that's a really exciting library. I really enjoy it. And the nice thing about that is, well, let me step back and tell you a little bit what core async is. So it allows you to set up almost like pipelines. I like to think of them as like pipelines of processing. And you can do this asynchronously. So you can set up these pipelines and send whatever sort of processing you want to it. And you can actually, just like pipes, you can build them up to other pipes.
But you're doing it asynchronously. Like, yeah. I understand the idea of, like, you know, sending this from sed to awk to more, et cetera, and then making a pipeline. But all of that's synchronous when I do it in shell.
Right. So you can make it asynchronously. And also, the library is available on the server side and in ClojureScript on the front end as well. So you've got that nice duality that you can take the same tack both on the server side and the front end. And the benefit of that on the browser side is it gives you asynchronous processing on the browser as well.
Oh, wow. I see. So they've mapped that asynchronous pipeline model to, you know, promises or whatever the thing within JavaScript that allows you to, you know, to manage those expectations asynchronously. So you're doing it in a familiar way without having to know idiomatic JavaScript.
Exactly.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Then you get into the power of macros. Now, I know what macros are from a C perspective. How do macros work in Clojure?
So macros are kind of like a way to do meta programming. But it allows you to almost add features to a language. So if you're in a language like Java and you wanted to add like this foo method, you've always wanted this foo method, and to actually get that added into the language yourself, you'd have to send a change request to I don't know who, and then years later, maybe it would get into the language. But you can do this fairly easily yourself with Clojure with a macro, and you can just add your foo that you wanted to call, and it would be there for you. So it makes DSLs, domain-specific languages, really easy.
I see. So it's kind of like I'm thinking about like extension methods on the .NET CLR where it's like, you know, strings should really all have this. I can't believe they didn't do that. Like, why? That's unacceptable. Or monkey patching in Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
So is this because the atoms, the pieces, the individual available methods that you have in Clojure are so basic? Like you have like if and you have do, but there's no when. So if you need a when, you know, is that you have to make that yourself. So then that becomes a macro.
Right, exactly.
What is the difference though between a macro and a helper function?
So, it's kind of gets a little bit hairy, trying to look at the difference of them. But, so some things that like a macro could do that a helper function. Oh, and let me just, say this, that if you can use a helper function and not a macro, you should always go with the helper function.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Because macros get complicated. They're not easy to write. You know, being a meta, way of meta programming. So mm-hmm. if you can do something the simpler way first, you should definitely do this. But some things you just cannot use a helper function for. For example, if you wanted to make a new way that would define a function.
There's okay. So you're changing fundamentally the language structure and how it works.
Yeah, or if you wanted to have, you know, something that you always wanted to add to defn.
To define
a function. Okay. That's something that you couldn't do with a regular function. So you'd have to use a macro to do that.
I see. So you can actually take over techniques and take over keywords within Clojure and change things fundamentally. Oh, okay. Interesting. So macros are these combinations of primitive, you know, forms that are built in, but not necessarily interchangeable with a helper function. But so it sounds like it's almost like taking the safety off the gun at that point. Like once you've made it that far into the book, you're probably pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you say that you're writing web apps. Like what's the Clojure on Rails? What's the web framework?
So it's a little bit different. Clojure as a language and an ecosystem doesn't really like frameworks. So we prefer kind of collections of libraries instead. So there isn't really a killer app like Rails or anything like that. So you'll see there's foundation libraries that kind of everybody uses or most people uses. Ring is a library for doing web servers. And that's one that you'll see a lot in the wild, mm-hmm. but there are also some libraries that combine other libraries that people put together to actually have some more batteries included, so you don't have to have a real pare down ring library to start out with.
It seems like in the research that I did that even if you go searching around for Clojure web framework, and this is again Googling in ignorance, which is what I do very well. You know, I'll say, "Oh, look, here it is. Here's one called Luminous, right? This is the solution." And then I get in there and it immediately says, "We're a micro framework and we're based on a set of lightweight libraries." So basically it's just someone drew a dotted line around some useful methods and functions and said, "Yeah, let's give that a name. That's useful for people to start with."
Exactly.
And it's like, "Well, wait a second. This isn't the DHH level opinion. Like you're not ordering me how to do things. This is just a collection of useful things." It's very kind of laissez-faire. Is the community like that? Just very micro framework?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely prefer libraries over frameworks. It's even better when these libraries are composable. Mm. Just like kind of keep it simple, keep it composable, keep it light. That's really kind of the Clojure ecosystem philosophy.
Yeah. When I went looking around on GitHub for different Clojure libraries, and by the way, you all have some of the best cool names. Like there's one called Composure, but again, the J is pronounced like an S, I think.
Yeah,
but, you know, it's so cool. Like when you have a really awesome name and everyone in the community goes for it entirely. And you start poking around and it's like, it's four files. You know, and a couple of K each. So this is the thing about it. It kind of speaks to the purity and the pragmatism of the language. Purity in the sense of, you know, here is the least viable thing I needed to be useful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I made it as clear and concise as possible, and I wish you all the best with it.
Very true.
That is great. Have you built up your own libraries and within your company or open sourcing?
Yeah, we are. We are looking at open sourcing, a couple where I think we have to get it more in a, actually, I think we have, but I think we do actually open source a couple, but the names of them are escaping right now. And we're looking to open source a couple more. I've worked on a couple libraries myself just for fun. One of them was for the AR drone called CLJ Drone. So
just to make sure people heard that, you made a drone, a library for you said an AR drone?
Yeah, the,
augmented reality? Is that what AR is?
Yeah, it does. It stands for augmented reality. It's a quadcopter.
Mm-hmm.
So, that was kind of my first Clojure library, just kind of learning language and playing with it. And that was a lot of fun being able to be in a REPL and having a quadcopter take off. So that, if you want to play around with quadcopters and Clojure, that's a fun place to start.
And that is actually your most popular. Isn't that funny how that works? That's your most popular GitHub repository. There's like almost 200 stars. People are like, quadcopter and Clojure? That's awesome.
It is pretty fun.
Now, you did a cool talk a couple of years ago about Alice in Wonderland as it relates to Clojure. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I'm sure if you've heard these, or if you've gotten into functional programming, then you start hearing new vocabulary that you haven't heard before. And one of the words that I heard when I got into functional programming was monad. And I had no idea what this was and what people were talking about. And I took the approach of, I'll just sit down during lunch a couple days and I'll figure it all out. And I still had no clue.
I have to say, I think I knew it once, but then it escaped me.
Yeah, they're like that. You figure it out and then it just goes away. But, so I decided to take a more hard approach of trying to learn it. And, in studying papers and, really kind of applying myself trying to learn it, I found maybe the best way of trying to explain it to myself and to other people was in the context of a story. So I'm a big proponent of storytelling as a way of teaching. And sometimes if you've got kind of a scary concept like monad, your brain kind of goes into anxiety like, oh my gosh, how am I going to learn this? But if you put it in the context of a story and an adventure of someone else doing it, you can actually problem solve and learn things a little bit better. So that's what that talk did, that kind of took an Alice in Wonderland approach to learning what monads were.
Can you give me a short explanation so that someone might leave this podcast, not only with a good understanding of Clojure, which I think you've done, but also they could tell someone at work what a monad is? Or is it something that takes another half an hour?
Well, the thing about monads are, they're almost very zen.
Exactly. Yes, it is. It is, you know.
That you probably already know them and you probably already implemented them.
Awesome.
But you won't realize that you have until you see the pattern a few times. So it's not really something that you can describe in words so much. You kind of just have to see it in code done like 3 or 4 times and you're like, oh, I totally have done that.
That is extremely Mr. Miyagi, kind of like, you know, hand, open hand. You're like, I don't know what you're saying, Mr. Miyagi, please help me. Fantastic. So the language is a Lisp. It runs on the JVM.
Mm-hmm.
It is functional but practical.
Mm-hmm.
The community, it sounds like they're a very welcoming community.
Yes, they are. In fact, that was one of the reasons I got involved in the community. I wanted to get involved with an open source project. And at the time, there was a group trying to make this website called For Clojure that I got hooked up with. And it's actually a four, and then it's Clojure. It's something to do with like foreclosure of homes.
Still,
but it's a wonderful, awesome puns continue. It's a wonderful site. So if you're interested in getting into Clojure, you can actually try little bite-sized, fill-in-the-blank, solve this Clojure problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very addictive, though, I have to warn you. Like, people have said they've stayed up for nights.
Really?
Yes. So beware as you're going there. But it's a fantastic site, and it was a fantastic first open source project to get involved in as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's at the number 4 closure.com. And there's a whole problem list. And it goes from elementary all the way up. It's almost like the, I feel bad. I'm on my own podcast and I'm blanking. What is the coding problems? The Euler, it's Euler, right? E-U-L-E-R, the Euler project.
Yeah.
Project Euler?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I think I'm pronouncing that right.
It does have some of those problems in there as well. But it takes more of, like a cone approach. Have you talked? It's K-O-A-N. So it's sort of the fill in the blank, small little bite-sized problems.
I see. It's katas.
Katas. Yeah, katas are a little bit bigger, I think. But yeah. But they're like small.
See, this is great. Now I have to go figure out how katas and koans and haikus and all of this fits in and what a monad is. People can also go to tryclj.com and they can just type this right in their browser. Mm-hmm. They can learn this.
To go too.
If I decide to go and do something in Clojure, but I'm not a Clojure shop, you know, our company hasn't bought into it, you know, what's the kind of work or processing or bite-sized thing that I could maybe start with to introduce this into a company?
Well, I mean, tests are always a good way to introduce a new language into a company in kind of a risk-free fashion. So you can start writing some of your tests in Clojure and gain experience with it. And then as your team kind of ramps up with it, then you could start using it for more things.
I see. That's a good idea. So if I'm a Java shop already, or even if I have a .NET shop, because there, I believe, is a full version of Clojure for .NET, then just bring in the extra, you know, the little bit of overhead that Clojure has as far as libraries and compilers, and don't change my existing code.
That's correct.
That is a great idea. And then if everyone starts to love it, it's the idea virus that changes the whole company.
Exactly.
So when is your book coming out and who is it with?
It's with O'Reilly. And it's coming out in a couple months, I believe, if everything works with the production stuff. So that is in April.
And O'Reilly books have an animal on the cover. Which is the animal we should be looking for?
Mine is a water rail. It's a bird.
It's a bird with a very long beak.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much, Karen Meyer.
Well, thank you.
So Karen's book is Living Clojure, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.